the sound of tens of thousands of demonstrators in Turkey last week. They took to the streets to protest. This was during a funeral of a 15-year-old boy who died in last year's anti-government protests. And after weeks of similar demonstrations, tensions between the Turkish people and their leaders have now ratcheted up again. Turkish Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan blocked Twitter yesterday after recordings revealing corruption in his inner circle were released online. So why is he so worried about the social media platform? Will his ban work or backfire? And also, let's talk about how Twitter is used as a tool for political change with Zeynep Tüfekçi. She's an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, and she happens to be Turkish. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, give us the background on how we got to this point. Why are people protesting now in Turkey?
Well, we got to this point in a complex story. The Turkish government, AKP, has been elected for the third time, increasing its votes a couple years ago. It looked like this perfect model of a success story. But honestly, in truth, there had been a lot of complaints and issues and things that people were worried about. But it was coupled with their growing control over mass media. What we have since learned from these leaks and what we already knew, and I knew from talking to journalists, that the broadcast media was heavily censored. It was to the degree that during the Gezi protests that we talked about, just a minute, not the ones that you just aired, but before in June of 2013, at the height of clashes in the middle of the biggest square in the biggest city in the country, Istanbul, CNN International was broadcasting live from it because it was such a big deal. CNN Turkey was showing documentaries about penguins. They were this heavily censored.
Wow.
If you turned on your television, you did not get real news.
And remind us what those protests were about.
The protests were sparked because there was a park in Taksim that the prime minister had personally intervened to have it transformed into a replica of an Ottoman barracks that would also be a shopping mall. It was an awful idea. It was not a popular idea, but it was a symbol of a government overreach. It was a symbol of micromanaging a local question, you know, directly from the prime minister. So the park itself wasn't that big a deal. People decided that this was it, we're going to draw a line. And the censorship itself, you know, not turning on your television and not seeing any news of the clashes, that you could actually just open your window and smell the tear gas, but you couldn't open, you know, turn on your television and see them. So people just flocked to social media. And I wasn't in the country at the time. I'm an academic who studies social movements, but I was born three blocks from where Gezi Park is, in a total coincidence. I just hopped on a plane. I said, I have to study this. I have to do research on something that is so close to my interests and also my home country. And I saw a park full of jubilant people who thought, Twitter, it's bringing us freedom because finally we can talk to each other and we can share news. So it was this powerful moment of people coalescing and breaking censorship and just drawing a line in the sand. And later in December, from a different source, a corruption scandal broke out in the country. And the government blamed its opponents in the judiciary, reassigned them. And what it seems as the judges and prosecutors who were reassigned seem to be retaliating by releasing alleged wiretaps of the prime minister and his circle, implicating him and his very close friends and family in a massive corruption scandal, which is, of course, not just on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube. And, you know, every night, instead of watching television, people are waiting for the release of new, you know, leaked recordings and
discussing it. Yeah, which Erdogan has said in some parts are lies or fabrications,
correct,
but he's admitted to some the truth to some
of the other ones. He vehemently denies some of them, and he accepts some of them as authentic. I am in no position to judge which is which. But what has happened is that the social media has made it very hard for the ruling party to govern the country as before, when they had an almost total control of the public sphere.
Well, he, in fact, said, I'm going to quote him on this. He said, this thing called social media is currently the worst menace to society.
That's right. He said that during Gezi. And then a couple of weeks ago, he said, Facebook, YouTube, we're not going to let, you know, our country be victim to this. And yesterday, he said in a rally, he said, Twitter, Schwimmeter, you know, he's going to make fun of it. We're going to wipe them all off. We're going to eradicate them all. I don't care what the world says. Now, the crowd cheered. So you have to understand this is a polarized situation in which there are people who are still supporters of the government and large numbers of people who are not on both sides, and a local election coming up. It's not a national election, so the stakes aren't as high, but it's still seen as a major referendum. So there's a lot of polarization, and a lot of it plays out on social media. And also, if people think it was just the pro-government people, I mean, it was just the anti-government people on social media, that was not the case until yesterday, until the government blocked Twitter. It was a place where a lot of supporters of the government, including the highest level officials, were out there tweeting themselves, too. Now they're not there.
Well, he has his own Twitter account.
Correct. He does. And even after the ban, the president of Turkey circumvented the ban himself and went on Twitter and said that he doesn't approve of, you know, a wholesale ban. And, of course, Turkish users were quick to chide him and say, well, what DNS address are you using to circumvent? And remind him that he himself had signed a massive censorship law. So it's a complicated situation. I'm still seeing even high-level government officials, you know, pop back up. And the official news agency of Turkey just broke the irony records a couple hours ago by tweeting, therefore circumventing the ban, about a press conference on why the ban was justified.
So do you think that he's going to relax and rescind the ban, or is he getting too much political mileage out of it?
He is getting political mileage out of it from some supporters, but to be honest, Turkish people have rescinded the ban. The number of tweets from Turkey is higher than the day before the ban. What happened is, at the moment the ban hit, my Facebook, which is full of many Turkish friends, and across the political spectrum, I have friends across the political spectrum, it just lit up as people shared information on how to circumvent the ban. And then, you know, as people figured out how to circumvent, my Turkish Twitter list started sort of popping back online, and then people created these easy graphics, and they're sharing it by other applications, you know, WhatsApp and other things. And then, as if that was not enough, people have printed posters on, you know, here's how to circumvent if you're an Android user, here's how to circumvent if you're a Mac user, and putting them up on bus stops. So the ban is all but ineffective for people who are choosing to defy this ban, which, as far as I can tell, is a large section of the population. Mm-hmm. And the only people who are not on it are people who are refraining from the circumvention. So, in effect, the Turkish government has banned itself from Twitter. That's all it's done, and has acquired this massive negative publicity to boot. Because social media is part of everyday life for millions of people. You know, that's where you go. You check on your friends. You talk politics. And in the case of Turkey, it's been a major counter to a pretty significant censorship on mass media.
Zeynep Tufekci is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina. She's also a fellow at the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton, and she happens to be Turkish. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, here in California, if you get arrested for a felony crime, the police can take a sample of your DNA. If you're found to be innocent, though, and you aren't convicted of that crime, the police will still hang on to your DNA profile. Privacy advocates hate this practice, and the ACLU challenged it in court. Yesterday, though, a federal court upheld it and said California authorities can continue taking and storing suspects' DNA. Josh Gerstein is a senior reporter at Politico. He's been following the legal and political ramifications of this story, and he joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Good, thanks. Well, tell us more about this process. What happens when you're arrested for and suspected of a felony crime?
Well, it depends on who arrests you. There are, I'm sure, some places in the country where you just get your fingerprints taken. But in a lot of states now, including Maryland and including California, if you're arrested for a felony crime or certain types of felonies, they take a swab of your DNA and then sort of boil it down, run it through some scientific processes, and come up with a kind of a profile of markers in your DNA, and they tuck it away in a database. They probably check it immediately to see if it matches up with people that they may be looking for in other cases, and then they basically put it away in case they ever need it again, much in the same way the government hangs on to your fingerprints, you know, once you're arrested, sort of regardless of whether you are ultimately convicted or what have you.
So that is, in fact, one of the arguments that the court made yesterday, saying that there isn't much of a difference, right, between fingerprints and DNA?
Yeah, I mean, the court, I don't think in its ruling yesterday, really put a lot more meat on the bones of this argument. They were largely picking up on a Supreme Court ruling that came out, last year, and that one essentially did basically buy that argument that there's not a huge difference here between what some people call a DNA fingerprint and an ordinary fingerprint. Of course, the people that are opposed to this kind of data gathering and storage think there is quite a difference. They point out, you know, someone looking at your fingerprints can't see if you have a genetic predisposition for some type of disease. Generally speaking, you can't look at somebody's fingerprints and figure out if their brother might have committed a crime, but you actually can do that sometimes with DNA.
And has that been done?
I think it has, but in some places it's restricted in terms of whether you can use it for familial purposes. But I think there have been some cases where people have found that someone who is a close relative of someone else might have been wanted for a crime. And these databases have been pretty successful at finding people in cold cases that have been closed for decades because some DNA was recovered. Especially because you think about it, the technology has really improved, and therefore it's a lot easier to match these things up now than it would have been 10, 20 years ago.
Right. So since the judges were relying on the Supreme Court decision from last year involving Maryland, is this now a done deal? There's nowhere else to go now that there has been already Supreme Court precedents?
Well, this is really the most interesting aspect of yesterday's decision. We should say it was to a what's called an en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit, which means 11 judges as opposed to the usual three that hear these kinds of appeals. And it's basically a definitive ruling from the Ninth Circuit on the case in front of it. But yes, they did. They left this door open a crack. At least 10 of the 11 judges said that it was possible. They basically turned down this lawsuit the ACLU had brought, saying that the California program should be stopped. And they said, look, the California program is largely similar to the Maryland program, and so we can see no basis for stopping it, since the Supreme Court said, albeit 5-4, that the Maryland one was okay. But the programs are not identical, and I think there are pretty strong arguments that the California program is broader and may pick up people that have committed crimes that some, we shouldn't say committed crimes, been arrested for crimes that some might regard as not as serious. There's this category called wobblers of cases that are sometimes considered a misdemeanor and sometimes a felony. So the California law on DNA collection test on arrest sounds broader than the Maryland one, and therefore the court left open the possibility that maybe the ACLU could get this law blocked in California with respect to people that are in that category of, crimes that might be considered on the edge between being serious and being trivial.
And then the other issue, as I understand it, is that in the Maryland case, if you are found not guilty, your DNA is destroyed, whereas in California, they hang on to it.
In California, they hang on to it, although if I'm correct, I believe that there is a process where you can ask them to get rid of it, but very, very few people do that. So, yeah, that's another distinction here in the process. But it didn't seem like that was terribly meaningful for this 11-judge panel, although, it didn't completely close the door on some future relief, though I know it was a disappointing ruling for the ACLU and the people who brought the case.
There's also a racial and social component here, too, right? Because most of the DNA is collected from minority suspects.
Right. I mean, I don't think anybody believes that they're collecting the DNA intentionally in a racially biased fashion. But if you just look at the populations of who is most likely to be arrested in society, and for what offenses and under what circumstances, you find out pretty quickly that disproportionately in these databases, I think no matter what state you're in, you get a higher proportion of minorities going into these databases. And when you talk about maybe on one state or another state, folks might not consider that serious, but there has been discussion about trying to join all these databases together. So there would be one big national database of DNA, and if that happened, I think people generally agree that it would be really disproportionately filled up with the DNA of African Americans and of Latinos, which sort of raises the question, if we think that information is useful as a society, maybe we should collect everybody's DNA and put it into a database. Why are we limiting ourselves to people who have been, you know, charged with certain crimes, even if not convicted?
Josh Gerstein, senior reporter for Politico. He covers legal and national security issues there. Thanks, Josh.
Okay, Madeline. Take care.
So how do you feel about police collecting and keeping DNA samples of people they arrest? Does that raise privacy concerns for you, or do you think it's a good weapon to fight crime? You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. Coming up, Divergent, Muppets, Fargo on TV. It's our weekly film segment that's coming up next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we have a very literary Friday film segment today. Divergent on the big screen, The Giver getting a film adaptation, and there's a David Foster Wallace biopic in the works. Joining us for all of that is Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business and editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter. Hi, Kim.
Hey.
And Tim Hain, he is editor of Movie Phone. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, all right. Let's talk about Divergent, which is going to, I assume, open big today. And let's first hear a little clip from the preview.
For it's me. You're in a sim.
He can't hear you.
Amazing, isn't it? Everything we think of that makes up a person. Thoughts, emotions, history. All wiped away by chemistry.
Four.
He's gone. And we're all safer for it.
Okay, for those of us who don't have children between the ages of, what, 8 and 18, what is this movie about?
So Divergent is about a character named Triss. Who, first of all, let me set up the world. So the world is future Chicago. It's roughly 100 years from now. Basically, the community has been set up into factions. So everybody is separate. Everybody has their sort of way of life. And Shailene Woodley plays the main character, whose name is Triss. And she is what they call divergent, meaning she doesn't fit into one of these factions. It's a little confusing for anyone who hasn't read the book.
Hunger Games-ish.
A little forced. It is Hunger Games-ish. It is
dystopian. It's
dystopian.
Everything is bad. Everything is bad.
Kim, how many dystopian movies can we endure?
I don't know, but this one seems to be on the list of those that we can endure. I mean, it seems conservative. I mean, it's one of these things like Twilight, which is not dystopian, but, you know, where the critics are just like ick and the public is lining up. So, so it looks like it'll open, you know, $65 million dollars. It's an $85 million movie. And it looks like this could be the kickoff of a trilogy because there are three books in this series and they're already working on the second one.
Or four movies. Because
it could be.
They like to split the finale
into
two movies.
They often do that when there's money to be made.
So this is a, by now, tried and true formula, taking a YA franchise and turning it into a movie.
Well, it's not always tried. I mean, there are those that work and those that...
Yes.
Which are the ones that...
Mortal Instruments.
The Golden Compass. Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch that...
Beautiful Creatures.
Yes, that's it. It's like anything in Hollywood. You know, when it works, it's so great. Mm-hmm. And when you swing and miss, it's painful.
All right. Well, they are going to try another one after this. It's called The Giver, and it's an adaptation from a Lois Lowry novel. Let's hear a little bit of the trailer that dropped this week.
From great suffering, great pain, came a solution. Communities. Where disorder became harmony.
The way things look and the way things are very different.
So that was Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep. So some heavy hitters in that one.
Absolutely. And this is not a franchise.
And this is a movie that is based on a book that came out, I believe, in the 90s. No. And the last time they tried to do that was with Ender's Game, bringing a book, very beloved, much older book to the big screen was Ender's Game, and it did not fare well. So
we'll see.
And they put a bunch of big A-listers in that, too. So
A-listers, there's some A-listers, well, I don't know if Tina Fey, I guess she's an A-lister. Mm-hmm. Ricky Gervais, and another A-lister in
they
the
are
Muppet
not
movie.
In The Giver. No.
Maybe they should be.
Yeah, that would be the really Giver part fun.
Two. I would also say that Kermit and Miss Piggy are A-list.
That's right. What am I thinking?
Yes, the Muppets are back again, I mm-hmm. guess. You know, the Muppets were adrift at Disney for a long time. Michael Eisner bought the company from Jim Henson. He died. And then they became kind of ignored and neglected to a huge degree. And I guess it's Jason Segel who mm-hmm. has a great love for the Muppets.
Yeah.
And there was a certain amount of static on the first movie because there are old school diehard Muppet people, you know, working for the Henson Company who felt like Jason Segel maybe didn't truly connect with the pure Kermit thing.
But what is the pure Kermit thing?
They have very specific ideas yeah. about what Kermit would or would not do. And they didn't necessarily think he was plugged into that. But the results, you know, the movie did well, and therefore the Muppets were somewhat brought back to life. And I guess that's got to be a good thing.
So this movie is, it's actually Kermit and his evil doppelganger,
yes.
I understand.
So, of course, Kermit is kidnapped and replaced with Constantine, who is the world's most wanted frog, and a jewel thief who's going after the crown jewels in London. And they go on a world tour, breaking into buildings, doing what they need to do to get to those crown jewels. It's very exciting.
Is
it's
it
funny.
Good? Did you like
has
it?
Has a ton of cameos. I did like it. I did like it. I mean, you have to take the Muppets for what they are.
Right.
They're the Muppets. You know, you're going to see them. You're going to see the myriad cameos that are going to show up. And there's some great jokes, some pretty hilarious jokes that are really parents are only going to understand. And you got to love those.
That's the dream. You know, want the kids to laugh and the parents to laugh mm-hmm. for a different reason.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, speaking of Jason Segel, he's apparently playing David Foster Wallace. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And I have no idea what to say about that.
Wow, that photo.
Quite.
Wow.
There was a photo came out
this week
online.
Of him yes.
on set.
Yes.
Dressed as.
And he looks rather like a guy who might ask you for money if you were on the 3rd
right.
Street Promenade.
I've heard comments, is the hair attached to the bandana? Like,
right.
what's going on?
It's terrible.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know what David Foster Wallace would have made of it. He probably would have written a scathing essay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. let's talk about the business of Hollywood for a minute, Kim, and talk about DreamWorks and what is happening with that studio. Hasn't had a hit in a long time.
DreamWorks, you know, it started out as a dream. It was going to be Steven Spielberg, David Geffen, and Jeffrey Katzenberg, and they were going to do everything, TV shows, movies, God, you know, big lot. They were going to have it all. And I'm not sure if they were even on the same page when they started it about what it was going to be, but it very quickly became nothing like any of that. And Jeffrey Katzenberg has now gone off and is running DreamWorks Animation, which is a separate company. And Steven Spielberg and Stacey Snyder have been running DreamWorks, and they just can't seem to buy a hit. They've had recently, there was the WikiLeaks movie.
The Julian Assange movie.
Which mm-hmm. just died. They had the thing with Vince Vaughn as the father of Hundreds of Children's Delivery Man. Didn't work. Need for Speed, which seemed like down the middle commercial play, mm-hmm. you know, just did not really connect with audiences. And so it just seems at a crossroads. Stacey Snyder, the partner with Steven Spielberg, is said to be going to Fox in a very high-level job, and that leaves Steven Spielberg, and everybody's kind of wondering, so then what is DreamWorks? What's left? And the answer is, unfortunately, probably a sort of a small production company, maybe.
Hmm. Well, Steven Spielberg, his strength is in directing.
Right.
Maybe not running a movie studio. Is that what people are saying?
Directing and producing. I think he's a great
producer. He's one of the most successful producers mm-hmm. in the history of the business, actually. But there's always been this thing about what is he doing for DreamWorks? And, you know, last thing he did was Lincoln, which is actually one of their hits. It did very well. But he hasn't necessarily delivered that kind of big War of the Worlds boom, boom hit.
Okay. Let's end on an up note.
I answered the darn... I'm cooperating here. And there's no...
You have no call to get snippy with me. I'm just doing my job here.
Of course, Fargo. Such a great movie. And it looks like FX is doing a television version of that. What do you make of that, Tim?
I think it looks good. I mean, it looks intriguing. And, you know, Martin Freeman is great. It looks like the casting's really interesting. Billy Bob Thornton's in it. They've got street cred, and it looks like it's going to be, I think they've got it for like 13 episodes, I think, for the first season. And I don't know. Does a movie always make a good TV show? No. But I'm willing to see if it
sometimes.
Will.
Sometimes. I mean, obviously, MASH, The Odd Couple. These were huge television hits based on movies. But for every one of those, there are probably quite a few that whiffed. Right now we have About a Boy, which is based on a movie. It just started on NBC.
And how is that?
It's hard to say at this point how it's going to do, but, you know, it just shows they're in there swinging.
They're still doing that.
Yeah.
We will say About a Boy, based on a book that was turned into a movie, and then the series based
the
on
Nick
the movie.
The Nick Hornby novel. Like,
right.
Kim Masters, host of KCRW's The Business and editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter, and Tim Hain, editor of Movie Phone. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another movie out today, a documentary called Anita. Coming up, my conversation with Anita Hill. Once an unknown law professor, she became a public figure after testifying in 1991 that Clarence Thomas sexually harassed her. We'll talk about how her life has changed since then after a news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Sexual harassment wasn't really well understood or even talked about much before 1991. And that's when an unknown law professor from Oklahoma stunned the nation with her testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Sitting alone at a table wearing an aqua blue suit, Anita Hill told the panel that she had been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas.
What happened next and telling the world about it are the two most difficult things, experiences of my life.
Thomas was her boss at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and she recounted sordid details of what he allegedly talked about. Pubic hair on Coke cans, watching pornography, his penis size, and the infamous Long Dong Silver porn reference. She says he pressured her for dates.
I declined the invitation to go out socially with him.
Thomas had been nominated for the Supreme Court, but Anita Hill's story threatened to undermine his nomination. And so when she began her testimony that day in 1991, both of their futures were on the line. After that 9-hour ordeal, Anita Hill and the country would never be the same. 2 decades later, Anita Hill's story is now being told in a documentary that opens in theaters today. And I'm joined now by the filmmaker Frieda Mock and by Anita Hill. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you.
Now, Anita, take us back to 1991. You were a young tenured law professor in Oklahoma. How was it that you found yourself testifying in Washington? You were in this big room packed with spectators, reporters, TV cameras. Did you want to go public with your Clarence Thomas story?
I found myself testifying after the Senate Judiciary Committee staffers came to me a couple of times. The first time with some general comments and asking for information about what the work environment at the EEOC was like. And then specifically, they returned with more specific questions about behavior, whether or not I had experienced sexual harassment when I worked for Clarence Thomas and whether or not he was engaged in that behavior. But it wasn't really until somewhat later in the process, the judiciary confirmation process, that the Senate actually came to me. And following that, I spoke with the FBI, gave a statement to the FBI, and then wrote my own statement in my own words and sent it to the Senate Judiciary Committee. And that was the statement that was leaked. And then ultimately, I was subpoenaed to come before the committee.
And Frieda, set the scene, because the Senate Judiciary Committee didn't really want to subpoena Anita Hill.
Well,
right.
From what she felt and what they, that it would be actually a closed hearing, and the document that she sent in would be discussed among them. That it was never known that it was going to be made public.
But there was this movement outside the halls of Congress to hear Anita Hill speak, and the Senate Judiciary Committee, from watching your documentary, really had to respond to public opinion.
Yes. Well, that was after the statement was leaked. And then the question was, were they going to reopen the Senate Judiciary hearings? And it was really the voice of many women, including House of Representative women, who walked up the steps to knock on the door of the Senate and demand that there be a hearing.
And Anita, when you sat before that panel of all white men, when did you realize that the questioning wouldn't be necessarily friendly questioning.
I don't think that I was ever thinking that it was all going to be friendly questioning. And I think there is a misconception that I assumed that it was all going to be friendly. But I think more importantly, it was very early on that I realized that it was not going to be very well-informed questioning. And also that I realized that there was going to be campaigning outside of the hearing room and statements made in press conferences denigrating my testimony, statements made by the members of the committee itself. So I think that was the more surprising element of it, or those two elements were the more surprising than what that there were. They lacked information about sexual harassment, the issue itself, and how it actually manifested itself in the workplace and in a lot of people's lives. And secondly, that then they would say that this is a fair process, but that at the same time they would go out and hold press conferences saying that I was a liar or a perjurer.
And then it was strange. You became the person on trial in a sense.
Well, first of all, it wasn't even a trial. It was a hearing.
Right.
But the common perception was, and it was a perception that was reasonable based on what was going on, was that, in fact, I was on trial. Even today, I hear from people saying, oh, I saw your trial. Mm. And I realized how harsh the treatment was.
If what you say this man said to you occurred, why in God's name, when he left his position of power or status or authority over you, and you left it in 1983, why in God's name would you ever speak to a man like that the rest of your life?
So did you feel like you were doubly victimized by going through this process?
You know, the word victimized is not something I use lightly. But I do think that, in fact, that the process was not fair to me. It was not fair to the public. And in essence, because of the process was so poorly done, poorly conducted, and all of the behavior that was going on outside the hearing, that it was a disservice to everybody.
Joe Biden, who obviously is now the vice president, ran those hearings. Has he ever talked to you since and expressed any kind of regret for how the hearings transpired?
I have not received any direct contact from him, or even there may have been indirect statements made to the press, but I've not heard from Vice President Biden or then Senator Biden before.
I just recently heard a quote, because the film is apparently some people heard it was coming out, that he it was quoted by a staffer saying he wishes the best for Ms. Hill.
So several of the senators who are on that panel have since died. Ted Kennedy, Paul Simon.
Howard Metzenbaum.
Hal Heflin.
Arlen Specter. Yeah, right. So lots of them. Yeah. The ones who have survived, did you contact them at all, Frida, when you were making this documentary to see how they look at this now?
I thought about that. I thought about perhaps talking with Senator Simpson and
Alan Simpson of Wyoming.
Of Wyoming, who did in 1991 characterize sexual harassment in a stunning comment. He said, "This is crap." So when I saw that, and it's in the film, I said, "How can one have a fair hearing when the mindset characterizes that action in such assertive way?" I did think about this, and then I finally realized that this is a story that hadn't been told, which is really Anita Hill's story. It's very full and rich, and it's the first time that we actually can have a chance to really understand who she is, how she came to be at the hearings, what has happened to her life.
And can I just comment on that? And I think what part of what people related to in my situation, and it's becoming increasingly women and more men, that was that the senators had all the power, which meant that they had the access to the press. They had staff who could help write statements for them. They had all opportunities to talk and explain what they were doing, much more so than I did as an individual citizen. And I think that's one of the things that people will find important about the film is that it shows what happens when an individual citizen is up against those kinds of powers. The fact that I didn't know members in the press, and that Senator Simpson had friends probably in the press, people he could go to, he could count on to get his word out and to get his story out. And this film, as many documentaries do, gives an individual the ability to speak out and to tell their story.
So when you returned to Oklahoma, you had become a public figure that you didn't intend to become. You were confronted on the street. State lawmakers tried to get you fired, and you were threatened, and you had to leave the job that you loved and the place that you grew up in and that you loved.
Well, I didn't have to leave. I chose to leave.
What did you feel? Why did you choose to leave?
Well, I chose to leave for a couple of reasons. One was that I didn't believe that I could be fully myself and fully explore the issues that had been prompted by the hearings in a way that just kept telling the truth and kept revealing women's experiences if I stayed there. I felt that there were just people who were resistant to hearing the experiences, and they were resistant in particular to me talking about them. And so that was one reason I left. And I also left because I knew that there were other places that could be more supportive of those efforts and that I could really be able to use other kinds of disciplines and other kinds of information and other kinds of partners to help me be able to understand and fully explain.
So you teach at Brandeis now, and perhaps many of your students weren't even born when you were testifying back in 1991. What do they know about you?
Well, they know me as a teacher. They also know me as an administrator. And the purpose of this film for me was not that people needed to know about me, this new generation, but the purpose for me is that the new generation, know about the history of the issue of sexual harassment. They read about it in the newspaper, and quite frankly, some of the stories are deeply troubling and resonate with them in their experiences in colleges and maybe even in high school or junior high school. And they don't know the history. They don't know how we got to where we are, and that it's possible to actually even change and improve further.
It's also, though, a story of sexism and a story of racism. And in fact, you talk about how that was inextricably mixed in the hearing. And I just want to play Clarence Thomas. He testified after you did, and he was very forceful. And I just want to play a little bit from his opening remarks.
This is a circus. It's a national disgrace. It is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, you will be lynched, destroyed, caricatured by a committee of the U.S. Senate rather than hung from a tree.
Wow. What did you think when you heard him say those words?
Well, you know, the whole idea of him using the lynching metaphor was offensive in part because we as African Americans know of stories of lynching or family members who have been lynched, neighbors who have been lynched in our history. And it was offensive because he had many times before refused to accept any kind of racial history as relevant. And then to use it as a shield to keep the discussion from talking about the very real sexism that was present in that day, I think it was strategic and quite cynical. But the other part of it was that he said that, you know, the individual will be caricatured by members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And that's exactly what was going on with me, that they were caricaturing me as someone who was delusional or someone who was scorned. And you see that the words that he's using actually describes what was happening to me. But because I hadn't said, in essence, played the race card, I sort of lost to him because he played it. So, you know, it was cynical, but it was very strategic and it was very effective when he used it.
Anita, do you think it's ironic at all that you and Clarence Thomas are really inextricably linked in the public's eye, people who are old enough to remember, that when people mention Anita Hill, they think Clarence Thomas and vice versa.
It's interesting. I'm not sure that they think Clarence Thomas so much as they think sexual harassment. And if that is the case, if they're thinking sexual harassment and helping people to understand it and helping us to combat it and address it, whether it's in the workplace or in the military or in our schools, then that's just fine.
Anita Hill and Freedom Mock. Freedom Mock's documentary, Anita, opens tonight in Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco. Frida will be doing Q&As after some screenings here in L.A. this weekend, and Anita will be at screenings in New York City. And Warren Olney is here now for a preview.
I'm just reflecting on that wonderful interview with Anita Hill. What an
extraordinary... It really sends you back to
that time. Yeah, it does. Well, and it brings you forward.
Yeah.
And what she just said, I thought, was very moving.
Yeah.
Very impressive.
She's an amazing woman.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about the World Cup, which, of course, is going to be in Qatar in 2022. And 1,000 immigrant workers have died in the process of beginning construction on the various facilities for the World Cup. There is, of course, a lot of pressure being put on FIFA, the organization that runs the World Cup, which was already getting a lot of heat for being in various repressive places, as is the International Olympic Committee. We'll be talking about that.
Oh, fascinating. That's coming up at 1 o'clock, to the point. And Warren Olney, thank you.
Okay.
And on this show, right before then, why sunscreens are better in Europe and why the FDA is taking so long to approve more effective skin cancer prevention ingredients. That's coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Bram. If you're planning a trip this summer to Europe, Asia, Central, or South America, one thing you probably should not pack is sunscreen. And not because those places don't have sun, they have a lot. But according to a coalition of public advocacy groups and dermatologists, those places all have better sunscreen than you can buy here in the United States. The PASS coalition says new, more effective sunscreen ingredients have been held up for years, awaiting approval by the FDA. Joining me now is Wendy Selig. She's president and CEO of the Melanoma Research Alliance, which is a member of this coalition. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, how old is the sunscreen technology we're using now in the U.S.?
The last time that a new sunscreen product or formulation was approved in the U.S. by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, was in the 1990s. So it's been a good long time.
Yeah. And meanwhile, these other places, Europe in particular, have developed more effective sunscreens?
Yes, they've had the opportunity to have a wider array of options for the public to purchase and choose to use. They have different formulations, they have different ingredients, they have different filters, and they have been using those for many years, whereas in the U.S. you can't get access to those products.
Why is it that the FDA hasn't approved these ingredients that have been on the market for years in other places and have been proven safe elsewhere?
So the process by which these ingredients and these formulations get to the market in the U.S. is a very cumbersome process of regulation, and it's sort of layer upon layer that's been built up over the years. And it's no one person or one agency's fault, but we have a system in place that is clearly broken. And even folks who have been working with it in the agencies recognize that it's not working the way it's supposed to be working. And that's done two things. One is it's sort of frozen in time what is available in the U.S. To what was last approved, you know, more than a decade ago. And two, it's had a chilling effect on these companies and their willingness to innovate and focus on the U.S. market.
Bottom line, when I put on sunscreen and I put it on diligently, am I not to think that I'm covered adequately? How do I know if I'm protected?
Well, I think we recognize there are good products that are available in the U.S., for sure. I think people who are diligent about using a broad-spectrum sunscreen that they can buy in the U.S., and they reapply, and they, you know, don't go out at the height of the day, and they do all the other things that one should do, know your skin, see a dermatologist, especially if you see something changing on your skin, wear a hat, definitely don't use a tanning bed. You know, all of those things are good things to do, and certainly you can do that here in the U.S. I think where the gap is, you know, so I'm a parent and I have school-aged kids who literally run away from me when I come after them to put sunscreen on before they go outside. You know, it's sticky in the spray. They don't stick to the skin. You have to kind of chase after them. They don't like the way it feels. Some of them are too white. They're chalky. There are all kinds of issues that make it easier for people to say, oh, never mind, I'm just not going to use a sunscreen because it's staining my clothes, or, you know, a whole variety of personal preference reasons. And so then what you have is that people aren't actually using sunscreen the way they're supposed to and reapplying as often as they're supposed to. And then those people really are not protecting themselves the way they should.
Well, I guess then, is that the problem of the user or the FDA? I mean, if you're not using the product correctly, then why blame the FDA?
Well, I'm not blaming the FDA. I'm basically saying that there is a need out there in the marketplace, and we have an industry that is trying to innovate to produce products that will address that need. And these products are available in other countries, and they're not available here. And we want people to have access to better choices. And the sunscreen that you choose to use and you use correctly is the one that's, you know, that's better than the one that you don't use. And if you're limited in your choices and you think all sunscreens are, you know, chalky and they don't meet your lifestyle, you're not going to use them.
Right. So you're saying that these other sunscreens from Europe are just more pleasant to use, and so people would use them more?
There is definitely that. They are also, as we understand, broader spectrum, which, you know, everybody agrees, dermatologists agree, is what's necessary. And we've learned a lot about the skin and the sun and UV in the last 10 years. And so all of that knowledge needs to be going into continually innovating improved products. You know, in every other industry, we want people to innovate, and we're not asking people to use their telephone or computer technology from 10 years ago. We're certainly not, you know, happily, finally, not asking melanoma patients who already have the disease and who need to be treated to rely on something that we had 10 years ago. This is a country that believes in, you know, continuous improvement and innovation. We have a system in place that is not taking that into account and allowing for it.
The FDA is saying, well, they gave us a statement. The FDA recognizes the public health importance of sunscreen use and has prioritized reviewing the safety and effectiveness of additional sunscreen ingredients as quickly as possible, given the agency's resources. So it sounds like the intent is there, but perhaps the funding is not.
Well, we've had some very productive conversations with the FDA. And so we have, you know, looked to them as our partners to say, let's work together, which is why we've been so pleased by the response we've gotten from the Congress to, on a bipartisan basis in the House and Senate now, legislation has been introduced to fix this process. And we believe that it needs fixing through legislation. So it's not just a matter of people at the FDA working hard. Lord knows they work very hard. But that the system itself is broken and it needs to be fixed.
Wendy Selig, President and CEO of the Melanoma Research Alliance, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's Friday, Jolie Myers.
Feedback Friday.
Feedback Friday.
First,
I love
want to point out that every day when that music comes on, Madeline and I have a dance party. So I hope that you guys are all having a dance party out there too when that song comes on. At the top of the show, we talked about that ban of Twitter in Turkey.
Uh-huh.
And speaking of Twitter, Twitter is 8 years old. Happy birthday, Twitter.
It's almost a tween.
It's almost a tween. probably is going to love the Divergent movie. They've Twitter set up this fun thing that'll tell you about your first tweet. I was apparently job hunting when I joined Twitter. I said I should be resume-ing instead of Twitter-ing, which is a little forced, I think. But most people do tweet about tweeting their first go around.
This is my first tweet.
This is my first tweet.
Someone on our staff
inaugural
said that.
Tweet.
I'm not going to say who.
Yes, we're not going to say who. But that's an almost universal thing. But not you, Madeline. Not you. Yours is totally hilarious. You are at the Mad Brand. And your first tweet is a message to at Madeline Brand. And you say, are you who I was 30 years ago? Hashtag existential angst. So Madeline Brand has the single greatest first tweet of all time.
Let me just explain that. There is someone out there that has Madeline Brand, the Twitter handle.
Right, and I figured you weren't talking to yourself.
Yeah, she happens to be a youngin.
She's a youngin.
So yeah,
did
I wasn't talking to myself in a really
she was
pretentious
you
way. Yeah, I did.
30 years
and she
ago
refused to give me her Twitter handle.
Oh, well.
Anyway.
We can't win all the time. I decided to go through the first tweets of some of our show guests today. Wendy Selig, the one we just heard talking about suntan lotion, that's the wrong word for it, sunscreen, tweeted about melanoma. Big surprise. And Josh Gerstein of Politico joined us to talk about DNA evidence today. His first tweet was, Israeli-American linguist leaker loses lawyer, with a link to a story about that.
So I think he likes alliteration, amongst other things.
Yeah, I didn't follow up with the rest of his tweets to see, but...
Okay, well, we have to end it there. We'd love to hear your first tweets. You can tweet at us. We are at KCRW Press Play. I am at The Mad Brand. And Warren Olney, To The Point, up next at 1 o'clock. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.